Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I'm sure others will be sort of meandering their way down here once they realize that they're in an empty room. So they'll be welcome to join us when they get here. This is our final contemporary issues before Christmas, so we will be off next week and the week after that. You're welcome to be contemporary the week after that, but I won't. And then we'll resume again on January 6th. So, and I will talk at the end of today about what we'll be talking about in January. So I'll give you a little preview of that, although, again, if I get boring, the book that we'll be looking at in January is right over here next to Bob, so just give him a wave, he'll pass it over to you, you can start reading ahead. So we spent the last few sessions kind of looking at the first century context of Jesus' ministry, and we had kind of built into that in the course of reading the book Always With Us as well, that kind of looked at the economic conditions and then the social conditions and the religious conditions around Jesus' ministry and the expectations that he was either fulfilling or creatively disappointing or otherwise up against. And part of the idea has been understanding why the Gospels tell the stories that they tell. That's what Henry Reitz was doing with us on the two Sundays that he was with us. And he's actually still a little bit with us in that mystical kind of fashion. He recommended the material that I'm going to be sharing with you today. This is still in the vein of understanding why the Gospels tell the stories that they tell in the way that they tell them. And we're going to shift from the first century to not quite the 21st century, but the 20th century anyway, which all of us were around for at least some part of. So, welcome.
Didn't know where to come.
You found us. You're great. So Henry wanted to make sure that we understood when he looked at the synoptic birth narratives, the birth narrative in Matthew and the birth narrative in Luke, he wanted us to notice a couple of things. One, that they tell different versions of the birth story. Mark tells no version of the birth story. John tells a completely different story about almost everything. So those are your Gospels. Henry wanted us to know that Matthew and Luke are not writing history in the way that we think of history. We think of history as tell me what happened when and in what order, right? Matthew and Luke, Mark, John, all of them, are writing not so much, here's what happened. What they're trying to convey is, here's what matters. Here's what matters about who Jesus is. Here's what matters about Jesus' ministry. And when you want to understand what they're saying about what matters about Jesus' ministry, you have to understand the context in which they were writing. You have to understand the economic, political, military, social oppression that people were suffering under at the time. You have to understand the questions of religious corruption versus authenticity. What's the temple? Is it not just is it right? Is it doing the right thing? But is it whole? Right? Is it authentically carrying out the ministry that God intended for the temple to carry out, or for the people's religious life to carry out with or without the temple? You have to understand sort of the prophetic hopes that Jesus is read in the context of. So it's the Old Testament prophets were writing into their own contexts, writing about the situations that were going on around them, and as particularly as we have interpreted them as Christians, as people in the first century were interpreting them, they're also being read as speaking forward into the future in some ways. Now, something endured about this gospel and the story that Jesus lived. The gospel stories created these communities that we've come to call in English churches. And the gospel has a tendency to, even up to today, to really sort of give the spark to especially liberationist kind of movements. So when enslaved African Americans were finding the resources that they needed to make for their own freedom, they found those resources in the gospel. And even the gospel as told in the book of Exodus. That was actually a very important book for them. But the book of Exodus is actually a major important source for the gospel story. We could talk about that another time. It also made a big difference in Latin America, which is where we're going to go today. Last week, Henry handed out, for those of you who wanted, the Gospel of Lucas Gavilan, which was a retelling of the Gospel specifically of Luke in the context of Mexico in the 1980s. And I have more copies of this I'd be happy to give you if you did not get one or got one and it's on the floor of your car or wherever it may be. I've got more. Today we're going to go actually a decade earlier, and we're going to go to Nicaragua. We're going to look at the Gospel in Art by the Peasants of Solentiname, which is a community in Nicaragua. And so we gave you something from one country, now we're looking at something from another country. The politics and the history of Central America are messy, and there are lots of themes that sort of echo from country to country throughout the 20th century. So you're going to need to know some history. I'm going to set Mexican history aside. It's actually tidier than the history of Central America. And I'm going to give you some history to get us started here in Nicaragua. So what you need to know about Central America in the 20th century. Spain colonized them in the 16th to 19th centuries. That's important. Spanish colonialism finally ended in 1898 at the end of the Spanish-American War. And then Central America found itself no longer under Spain's shadow, but still between the United States and the rest of the world. So in the 19th century, Central America was between the United States and Spain. In the 20th century, Central America was primarily between the United States and the Soviet Union. And you remember the domino theory that we had to contain socialism in sort of as far away as we could get it, because if one of these smaller countries between us and them were to become a communist country, then boom, 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 the dominoes would all fall, and pretty soon they're right at our doorstep. That was sort of the prevailing American foreign policy throughout the 20th century with respect to the Soviet Union. I should say the middle two-thirds of the 20th century. The very beginning and the very end, obviously the Soviet Union was not in existence, and so things were very different. So Nicaragua, being one of those Central American countries, was right in that between. And so it was stuck between the United States and U.S. interests and the Soviet Union and Soviet interests on the other side. And then there were a bunch of people. These are people. And the people were stuck in between there too, trying to survive and fighting for their freedom in the midst of this. This was also a religious situation. The church hierarchy, the Roman Catholic Church, was the dominant religious player in Central America, still is for the most part. The Roman Catholic Church hierarchy tended to favor the United States or at least U.S. interests. Local priests and local church community leaders often sympathized with the socialists. There is a distinction, particularly in Central America, between socialism as a movement and the Soviet Union as a political player. Although obviously the Soviet Union was on the side or worked alongside the socialists. So we are not just in Central America broadly, we are in Nicaragua. Nicaragua was independent more or less for most of the 19th century, was occupied by the United States for the first third of the 20th century, and then a local Nicaraguan government led by the Somoza dynasty more or less. Somoza and his sons and his successors from 1936 to 1979. The Somoza family and their successors were in control of Nicaragua. Somoza was supported by the United States. FDR probably never actually said the line about he's an SOB, but he's our SOB. That line was actually already sort of current before the time FDR would have said it, but he would have said it if it had needed saying. Somoza was supported by the United States during that time. He was brutal. He rose to power, this will be important, Anastasio Somoza in 1936, he rose to power after assassinating you could call him a guerrilla, you could call him a freedom fighter, it sort of depends on what side you're on, by the name of Augusto Sandino. So when we talk about the Sandinistas, they are taking their name from Sandino. So sort of claiming his mantle. The folks in the picture here belong to the FSLN, the Sandinista National Liberation Front. And from beginning in 1961, this group was organizing, spent most of the 70s fighting a guerrilla war. This image is the FSLN marching into León, which served as the capital for the Sandinistas in sort of the end of the 70s. Somoza, the last of the Somocistas, stepped down in 1979, and the FSLN took control in Managua, which is the overall capital of Nicaragua. It was after this that the United States started supplying arms to the Contras, who were the counter-revolutionaries, these being the revolutionaries. Revolution, of course, is a very important socialist term. The United States was supplying the Contras after this, but they had the U.S. had always supported the Somocistas, the reigning SOB, not these. Full disclosure, the Sandinistas were also brutal. Nobody came out of this conflict clean, right? We're going to look at some art that comes from the Sandinista perspective, but I want to look at the way the gospel is used without necessarily saying that the Sandinistas got it right either, right? There were really similar sort of political and economic tensions present in Mexico throughout the 20th century. That's why we got Lucas Gavilan. If you read that, you'll hear echoes. If you look at this and then read Lucas Gavilan, you'll see echoes. If you are familiar with the history of El Salvador in the 1980s, you'll see very similar themes there, that we had a right-wing government fighting against left-wing guerrillas. And again, the church appears on both sides of the conflict, the hierarchy typically on the side of the right-wing incumbent government, and the local base communities often on the side of the left-wing socialists. And there was real theological development that took place in this historical setting that really grew out of the church's rootedness in these base communities, in the lives of the people in their place, rather than the sort of colonial hierarchy that had continued to be in place. So here's where we're going to be today. We're using some of the work of Ernesto Cardenal, he's still living, a liberation theologian. He was all along a leftist. He participated in a revolution against Somoza in 1954. He became a priest in 1965. He's since left the priesthood. But he founded a Christian community among peasants on the Solentiname Islands after the Sandinistas won the revolution and took over. He became the Minister of Culture. He left the FSLN, the Sandinista Party. He left in 1994 because it turns out Daniel Ortega was also an authoritarian. So Cardenal came to this community as a priest to sort of build a community here. Here are some maps. So in the inset, you've got all of Central America. So there's the United States up here, Mexico, so forth, Nicaragua. El Salvador is right up there. Nicaragua is right down here. We are in sort of the south, the west side of southern Nicaragua. Here is Managua, which is the capital. And there are two big lakes, Lake Managua right on it's not on the shore of Managua, the other way around. And then a bigger one, Lake Nicaragua. This is a volcanic area, so this is a big volcanic basin right here. The Solentiname Islands are way down here at the lower tip of Lake Nicaragua. The community of Solentiname was itself a hotspot for the FSLN. Many members of the community fought on the Sandinista side. The community was burned to the ground in 1977 by government forces. This is during the time of Cardenal's ministry there. The community continues today. It's focused on being an art colony. That's part of what Cardenal brought or lifted up from them. They also focus on ecotourism. This is a beautiful natural area. And Cardenal sat down with members of the community and worked with them to create commentaries on the Gospels, and commentaries coming from the specific situation that the people occupy. So he wrote, he along with the community wrote these commentaries that were published in 1975 to 77, right at the height of the guerrilla war. They were later painted into this in this primitivist style that Cardenal helped to develop. So the pictures that we're going to look at are painted by members of the community based on commentaries that the community wrote about the Gospels. And they're going to depict scenes from the Gospels. The pictures are going to look kind of childlike. The idea is to the idea is what is being portrayed, not the elegance of the portrayal. So it's a lot like folk music in the U.S. in the 1960s. The idea is not to have a refined presentation. The idea is what you're presenting. So these depictions are based on these biblical commentaries. And in each picture, as we look at them, we'll flip through them maybe quicker than we might otherwise, because there's a whole gospel here to cover. And as we go through them, I want you to just notice, where is Jesus? Where is he in the picture, although you'll have to find that. But where is Jesus positioned? Kind of where is he socially? Where is he religiously? Where is the community portrayed? What is this scene identifying about the lives of the people who painted it? And this is the way that we also tend to use the gospel from our own perspectives. So recognizing how someone is making use of the gospel from their perspective helps us understand what we're doing with it and what the gospel invites us to do. So we'll start at the very beginning. It's a very good place to start. This is the Annunciation. So here you have Mary. She's traditionally depicted doing sort of domestic tasks and or studying. And the angel shows up. And so you can see how the houses are portrayed. You can see the landscape behind them. You can see the era in which this is set. So this is a contemporary to the time setting of the Annunciation. After Gabriel tells Mary that she's going to have a baby, turns out he has already told Zechariah and Elizabeth that they're going to have a baby. So Mary goes to visit. There's pregnant Mary, there's pregnant Elizabeth, her elderly cousin. Another classic scene from sort of from religious art. You can see the Lake Nicaragua in the background with additional islands. So the Salentaname Islands are half a dozen islands, some larger than others, at that southern tip of Lake Nicaragua. So you can see the setting in which the people lived portrayed in the art. And this is the Nativity. So you noticed Mary lived in town, right? She lived in a nice stucco house, and Elizabeth had a tile floor, right? How many tile floors did we see in El Salvador, right?
Your family.
But Jesus is born elsewhere, right? Jesus is born in Bethlehem. He's born sort of out in the sticks, right? Out in the canton, if you will. And that house looks pretty familiar. The building materials are less organic and more metal when you can get your hands on it in El Salvador. But that looks real familiar to me. So Jesus is born out, right? Here are the shepherds doing their shepherd thing. They've got some sheep. They've got boxes of stuff. Bring presents. Here's the wise men. So notice there's still, this is a collection of different artists, so there may not be any significance to the change in the setting of the family, although traditionally the family is understood to have moved from a stable into a house, because Matthew said house. Here's the wise men. Start noticing how the people around Jesus are pictured. I can't make out exactly what the dress of these the Magi necessarily corresponds to directly, but notice that the people around Jesus are also socially positioned. Here's the flight into Egypt. Remember that King Herod wanted to come and worship Jesus, so he said to the Magi. The Magi were warned in a dream that they should not go back to Herod, so they didn't. Herod got really mad. Joseph was warned in a dream to take the family and run. And they lived as refugees in Egypt for a time because of what's coming next. This is the slaughter of the innocents. That's what Herod did after he realized that the wise men had duped him and had not helped him identify who was the baby born to be king of the Jews. He sent the soldiers and had all of the boys under 2 years old killed. Notice how the Roman soldiers are dressed. The government soldiers are portrayed as the Roman soldiers. This whole story, incidentally, I'll actually preach about this on January 6th. This whole story reads way differently to me now that I have been to El Mozote, where this happened. This certainly happened in Nicaragua as well. We've been to the place where it happened in El Salvador, happened in Nicaragua, continues to happen. This is not a one-time historical event.
But Nathan, just as a footnote, it wasn't just boys 2 years and younger.
Right.
At El Mozote, it was everybody.
Right.
With one lucky survivor.
Right.
To tell the story.
That's right.
The whole, all ages.
Yeah. So it happens that there's no like contemporary historical record of Herod issued a decree that every boy under 2 years old in Bethlehem and environs had to be slaughtered. There's no historical record that the slaughter of the innocents happened. It seems like the other evangelists probably would have picked up on that too. That was a pretty big deal. But again, like I said, the evangelists were not writing history in the way that we are used to thinking about history. They were writing theology. They were writing, here's what the story of Jesus means, which is to say that this doesn't need to have happened at one particular moment in Bethlehem. This is something that happens. Progressive tense, right? This is something that happens. Jesus, after having been in Egypt for a time, once Herod the Great died, Joseph and family moved back from Egypt. They moved not back to Bethlehem, but to Nazareth, right? So we're harmonizing all of the Gospels here in Salentiname, despite everything Henry told you last week. Here they are in Nazareth, which is conveniently more or less a lakeside town, as is Salentiname. You can see the lake in the background. Remember that medieval European religious art had local landscapes in it as well, so it's not like Salentiname invented painting the local territory into the biblical story. That this is actually, this is a long-standing tradition. Here is Jesus being baptized. The two important mountains of southern Nicaragua are in the background. Here's the beheading of John the Baptist. Depending again on how you harmonize the Gospels, at least one of the Gospels has the beheading of John the Baptist as the event that kind of precipitates Jesus' ministry. So Jesus begins his public ministry when John is executed. So here's John, and that's Herodias carrying the carrying John's head. But notice which one of those people is Herod. This is Herod Antipas, the one who had John beheaded. Who is he? How is he dressed?
That one with the military.
Yeah, he's got the like the generalissimo sash thing and the military with all of the medals. Because where is Jesus and this reformist revolutionary community positioned, right? Here's Jesus calling the first disciples. So there's Jesus. So if that was Herod, who are the disciples? Herod was the military leader, the powerful government figure. Who are the disciples? the common folk,
yeah,
fisher people, the peasants, right? So there's a really stark class division going on here. That class division was sort of historically present and is being read into the Gospels. Well, the Gospels have class division all throughout them, if you're attending to where that is, right? So here is Jesus calming the storm. Notice again, he's on Lake Nicaragua. So you can recognize the landscape doesn't change, right? The landscape is always Nicaragua. And so people who live on islands, it's nice to have a Jesus who can calm the storm. Here's a wedding, the wedding at Cana. So Jesus is making some wine there in the back room. And people are hanging out doing their wedding thing. Jesus teaches the Lord's Prayer. Again, gets up out of the lake, goes up the hill, sits down and teaches. Sounds exactly how it's told in the Gospel of Matthew. It's just painted in the local idiom. Here's Jesus giving the Beatitudes. Again, up the lake shore from the lake. Notice who's not here to hear the Beatitudes.
I don't see any military.
There's no military here. There's no government here. There's no elite here. Go back and read the Beatitudes. Read whom Jesus is addressing when he speaks the Beatitudes. Compare Matthew and Luke because they're interesting in contrast to each other. But I want to say it's in Luke. He actually speaks the Beatitudes in the second person. Blessed are you, right? Blessed are you who are poor. Blessed are you who are hungry. He's speaking not to the elite, right? He's speaking to the poor. Here's the rich man and Lazarus. So you remember the house that Jesus was born in, right? And you remember even the house that that Mary lived in before the Annunciation, and it was traditional sort of stucco or adobe, or stucco over adobe, perhaps. Notice the kind of house that the rich man lives in. A wooden house. And this is really a literal presentation of this parable. It's verbatim. There's a dog licking the sores of Lazarus, and he's in the doorway, and the rich man has food enough to spare, and it's that parable bites hard to me. Here's the parable of the Good Samaritan. So you've got the Samaritan, but you've also got the priest and the Levite and the religious leader. Notice that they are dressed like Roman Catholic religious leaders. This gospel does not pull punches. Here's the parable of the sower. So this looks like planting time in Nicaragua. The hat, I didn't show you a picture of Augusto Sandino, but that's his hat. His hat became sort of a political statement to wear hats in his style. Here's Jesus multiplying the loaves. So he's got 5,000 people more or less sitting here and feeding them all. Notice that there's not a lot of other food to be had in the scene, right? It's all the loaves in the basket. Here's Mary anointing Jesus. A couple of things struck me about this picture. One is that there are more women here than I was expecting. There are more women here than are told in the Gospels, in the text of the Gospels, right? Notice also the fancy boat in the background. They're not necessarily at this party, right? They're having their own party. But here's Mary anointing Jesus. The Samaritan woman at the well. So, again, a very sort of the place depiction of this. Here's Jesus entering Jerusalem. So that triumphal entry. He only has one animal here, so they must have used Luke's telling rather than Matthew's. Notice, so here he comes, marching into town. There are a few people in their doorways in town, but the people are following him, and they are carrying political signs. They're carrying political signs about Sandinismo and the FSLN and Long Live Jesus the Liberator. Again, sort of taking that very political story and remembering that it's a political story. Here's Jesus driving the merchants out of the temple. What's the temple? No. What's the temple?
The sanctuary.
The sanctuary of a
Catholic church.
Catholic church. That bites me hard, right? The role of the temple, which is the role of the church, right, is to mediate the presence of God to the people. So Jesus chases the money changers out of the temple, and it's depicted here as being the religious establishment of Nicaragua at the time. Painted by a community led by a priest. So this is all of those religious divisions within Nicaragua. The place that the church tried to stand on both sides of this conflict reads for me directly back into the way that the Gospels present Jesus as a religious reformer up against the religious institutions around him. And so if I don't then turn around and read that as a critique of my way of being a religious leader, then I am missing something really important. Okay, that was just for me. Here's the Eucharist. Can you get all 12?
13.
Yeah. Well, yeah, 13 plus, 13 and counting Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are in sort of traditional positions from the tradition that gave us Michelangelo's Last Supper. Mm-hmm. That tradition existed. But again, notice where they are. They're on Lake Nicaragua in an upper room. They may actually be on Lake Managua right now, I suppose. I should be fair, because they would be much more central. Here's the betrayal. They're in the Garden of Gethsemane. And, okay, who are the Roman soldiers who come to arrest Jesus?
The military.
The military. You've got this guy over here dressed in what is almost the uniform of the FSLN. I would sort of identify him with the disciple Simon the Zealot, because Jesus had militant revolutionaries among his inner circle. They weren't all, right? One of them was a tax collector, one of them was a zealot who would kill all the tax collectors and move on if he could. So that's the group that Jesus brought together. So probably significant that it's not all people dressed as FSLN members, but there's one there, and you can tell which side he's on. Here's the arrest. They're going to drag Jesus away. Here's Jesus before Pilate. So here's Pilate. He's dressed secularly, right? He's a secular government person. They seem to be, this is either a religious building or a government building built sort of in a religious idiom. That's fairly common in that era of Latin American architecture. To have crosses on the top. And, like, I mean, remember how I started the history of 20th century Latin America with 16th century Spanish colonialism? The tradition of secularism is a specifically United Statesian thing. The idea that government should be secular. Here's the way of the cross. The government soldiers making Jesus carry the cross. And the signs that the crowd is carrying are different now. They're not cheering him on anymore. Here's the crucifixion. Here is Jesus being laid in the grave. And looks just like a cemetery with crosses over the graves, right? Because don't forget the religious world that the gospel is being read into now. And here's the resurrection. So notice here how barren the cemetery is, right? And notice where Jesus is raised from this lush garden. You can also notice, if you're paying really close attention, that is an FSLN flag tucked in behind Jesus. Again, sort of the revolutionary movement of the people, which again is not the gospel, right? But the idea of the revolutionary movement of the people sort of embodies a resurrection in a way.
I was noticing the picture before this that looked like all the graves were fresh graves. There's no grass on them.
Oh, yeah, look at that. Yeah, so it could be that all of these graves are fresh, right? Because this war is still actively going on. There are lots of new graves at a rate higher than one per person, right? So those are fresh graves, and these graves are now sprouting and growing, right? So it even invites you to think about a different time frame of the resurrection that doesn't have to be, oh, we've only got 3 days to pull this off, right? Like, God can work resurrection at paces that we aren't necessarily interested in God working resurrection, both directions. So notice kind of throughout here the way that the gospel and the economic context of the people work together to invite people to sort of place themselves politically, to place themselves relative to the structures around them. I want to say one more time, Sandinismo is not the gospel. And we would completely miss the point if we were to write off this portrayal of the gospel for the reason that its portrayers are aligned with a specific political movement. Because the gospel here is still recognizably the gospel, right? It's still recognizably God standing on the side of the poor and the oppressed, and it's still standing recognizably on the side of God is about creating new life out of death. So it's recognizably the gospel, and it's recognizably political and economic, both at the same time. So I want you to take away three things from this, and then I'm going to speak very briefly about what we will look at in January. One is, I think it's worth us noticing the ways that we also use the gospel to support our own political and economic loyalties. Even though my political and economic loyalties are correct, right? It is still not, it's not a given that I ought to use the gospel to support them in the ways that I do. But I will use the gospel to support my loyalties because that's a way of making meaning in the world, right? It's a way of identifying where the gospel is in the world. Second, notice how the gospel worked here in Nicaragua to create this vision of liberation in the face of historical oppression. and the ways that the gospel specifically critiqued the powers that be. The gospel only makes sense from underneath. I think that's part of why Cardinal left the FSLN in 94, because there he was at the top. And that's not where the gospel works, right? The gospel undermines those who are at the top for the sake of those who are at the bottom. Recognize too, especially given the way that this portrayal was so explicitly partisan, I invite you to recognize the way that the gospel is present also in the politics of those whom you disagree with. Especially in the politics of those whom you disagree with, because you already understand the parts that you agree with. It's the parts that we disagree with where the gospel is still transforming us. So I don't know if that's particularly a word to those of you who are like, oh, I can't believe we're lifting up the Sandinistas here, or particularly a word to those of you who are like, yeah, those are my people, right? But notice that the gospel is still speaking in those, in even and especially those we disagree with. Okay, we're going to make a transition here heading into January, and we're going to sort of stay in this sort of economic conversation, but I want to shift from this more sort of abstract conversation about it that we had with Liz Theo Harris and then with Henry Reitz and even today. And I want to shift toward something more practical. So we're going to look at the ideas in this book, Building the Good Life for All, Transforming Income Inequality in Our Communities. Here's a really quick snapshot. Our well-being is interdependent with everyone else in our community, which is another way of saying Jesus is present in the least of these. And Jesus' presence in the least of these is especially a call to those of us who are economically more. That doesn't, like, we don't even want to say that, right? Now, Covenant has always recognized the presence of Jesus in the least of these through our mission of compassion and giving and so forth. We're going to ask some questions about how, well, on the one hand, how well we do that, and on the other hand, what we're trying to do as we really support others in our community and share in the well-being of others in our community. Shannon Jung is the author of the book. He explores four strategies from the standpoint of, he calls, mutual flourishing. That's a way of talking about interdependence. So it's not just poor people are a problem, we have to fix that, but rather all of our well-being depends on each other. The four strategies are relief, which is give them what they need, right? Self-help, which is teach a man to fish. Cultural formation, which is how do we change the attitudes that we carry through the world that point either toward mutual interdependence or away from it. And advocacy and governmental action. So what's the role of a government structure in addressing economic inequality? Jung is going to ask us to pay attention to not just what works about each strategy, but what doesn't work about each strategy, or what are the situations and purposes for which a strategy works or doesn't work. How could these strategies work together? And where can we get started, or in our case, where can we move forward? We're all already pretty well started. I like this book especially because so many of the ways that we disagree with each other politically about how to address poverty in the world, I think, reflect differences about which strategies we should employ and when. So how much, when, to what extent should we offer direct assistance? How much, when, and to what extent should we offer sort of those self-development approaches? How do we balance these things? I think there's room for all of these strategies, and I think it's productive for us to recognize that they don't all work for the same aspects of income inequality. So just like before, advanced reading is helpful, but it's not required. So there's a sample book and a sign-up sheet right over here in front of Bob. If you'd like to sign up for a book, and we'll get those ordered promptly and try to have them to you before the end of the year.
What is Jung's background?
Jung is he's a retired ministry professor. He taught pastoral theology and pastoral practices at the University of Dubuque Seminary, which is our Presbyterian seminary in Dubuque. He then moved to St. Paul Seminary in Kansas City, which is a United Methodist seminary. He is now retired. And he has specialized in things like rural ministry, the theology of food, the ways that sort of in our everyday lives we connect with who God is.
So it's fair to say he's an Iowan?
No, he's a Southerner, and I don't remember where in the Southern he is. He's retired to Florida now, but I don't recall where he hails from, but you can hear where he hails from when he talks.
Okay.
All right. Well, everyone, thank you for your attention this morning. We've got a Christmas program coming up in 8 minutes. So I will see you there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.